Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, and I guess good evening for some parts of the world. My name is Preeta, and I'll be your host for our weekly Global Awakening Call. Today, our special guest speaker is none other than the incomparable Sonia Shaw, someone who really reflects and has walked today's theme of witnessing suffering and transcendence in the most extreme places. Here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Sujatha Balika, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Sonia, and by the top of the hour, we'll roll into a Q&A and a circle of sharing. So this week's theme, as I shared earlier, is witnessing suffering and transcendence in the most extreme places. One experience I found that is often in the most extreme parts of our lives and in the most extreme places that we actually do, and in the most extreme suffering, that we actually have the opportunity for transcendence. So our guest this week works in the culturally difficult area around sexual harm. She works with survivors and people who have committed it, and often feels like doing this work is like walking through the eye of a needle, because it requires practices and processes that produce the trust and safety needed for people to express, as she says, the worst thing that ever happened to me, the worst thing that I ever did to another, and the thing that I've never told anyone. And they seek to do this for the benefit of their own healing, wellness, and liberation. The theme asks each of us to consider that in our experiences, what conditions and designs foster the kind of deep trust and safety that enables the deep excavations of the soul and open sharing. Since we have the pleasure of such an amazing moderator, Sujatha Balika, today. So with that, Sujatha, I'd like to invite you to introduce Sonia and dialogue with her.
Wonderful.
And then around the top of the hour. Yeah, sorry. In the top of the hour, we'll open it up for Q&A. Yeah, please.
Great. So it's really my joy to introduce and interview my lifelong friend, Sonia Shaw. I'll tell you a little bit about her and then want to go into this dialogue with her, because I want to leave lots of time and space for Sonia to share her wisdom and the beauty of the work that she does and the beauty she brings to it. So Sonia is a gifted facilitator of restorative justice practices, which she does in her home, in her community, in schools and prison settings. She's been teaching social justice education for 20 years. But for the past decade, she's been seeding restorative justice and trauma healing modalities locally and across the nation. And she brings her experiences as a survivor of child sexual abuse to her work, and that's really critical to her analysis and her approach in her work. So something you'll hear about her talk about today is that she's currently facilitating circles for survivors of sexual harm and the people who have committed sexual harm. And that's work she's doing through an organization that she's founded and aptly named Project Ahimsa, which offers non-punitive approaches to addressing and healing harm through workshops, trainings, circles, writing. Project Ahimsa's work is grounded in restorative justice, trauma healing, transformative justice, and critical pedagogy. Before she was at Project Ahimsa, she was the replication, training, and curriculum director at Insight Prison Project, where she was responsible for oversight of the Victim Offender Education Group, and that's work, again, that she did across the state of California and nationally. And as well, she's involved in Crime Survivors for Safety and Justice, where she's a member and a founding member and a chair of that entity. And she's also served on the advisory board of Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth and as a board of trustees for the California Institute for Integral Studies, where she's an associate professor. So her credentials are numerous, and I don't want to take too much time with things like, you know, her BA from Brown and her master's from the Art Institute, her Fulbright fellowships and her Jacob Javits fellowships. I think more important is for you to have a snapshot of who I've known Sonia to be since she was 16. And I think more than anything, what I can say about her character is that she is a true friend, not just to her friends, but to her colleagues, to students, to books, to concepts, to institutions, to the idea of liberation. She brings an ethic of deep relationship to everyone and everything she engages in. Another thing that's also always been true of her is genuine curiosity. She's inquisitive without inquisition, and what I find beautiful is that despite sort of her lengthy list of credentials, she's lately been describing herself as a student of life, of spirituality, of many things, and she assumes that student role with humility and joyful curiosity. And this is illustrated, I think, by the 5 questions for Sonia that you can find online. At the end, when she was asked by Service Space for a one-line message for the world, she responded with a question, which is, what kind of world could we co-create if we lead with love, compassion, and non-judgment? The fact that her one-line message is a question, not a rhetorical one, you know, but a genuine one, a hopeful one about the nature of interconnectedness, I think says it all about who she is and what she brings to the world. So I'm so thrilled to be asking her some questions today. And so I'll start with the first one, Sonia, which is, so there are these amazing, many beautiful things you do in the world with survivors, as a professor at CIIS, in prisons, in your work to understand the causes and conditions that give rise to sexual harm, and your support and lifting up of other people's work, particularly formerly incarcerated people. And then, of course, there's things like your amazing parenting of 2 little ones, getting less little every day. So I wish we had enough time to learn from you about each of these things, but I'd love for you to start maybe with your work with the prison system. If you want to talk a little bit about the current work that you're doing, that would be wonderful.
Thank you, Sujatha, and thank you, Preeta. First of all, I just want to say it's a ridiculous pleasure to be interviewed by my best and closest friend of 25 years. I'll start by talking a little bit about my work in the prison system, because I think that's probably most appropriate for this subject matter. And to add a little bit of context, so I've spent the last 8 years working in many different prisons from San Quentin, a lot of time at San Quentin. And I've been up to the tip of California, to Pelican Bay, down to the tip of the bottom of California, to Chuckawalla State Prison by the Arizona border, and done some significant work seeding really trauma healing and restorative justice practices groups inside those prisons. And by seeding, what I mean is merely and simply creating the conditions for people to experience their own agency that leads to more internal liberation and probably lots of other things. And, you know, one could ask a question, well, why do you need somebody from the outside to come in and do that? And to understand the nuances and the intersections of the prison system is that people on the inside can't actually meet without someone from the outside. They can't convene without someone from the outside coming in to kind of hold and start those containers that then start to run themselves. But there is a role of bringing in really simple tools of deeper processing, of thinking about shame, of thinking about forgiveness, about accountability, of trauma, of resiliency, of grief and loss, that kind of help those processes along. So Sujatha did a beautiful list of all of the things I do. And one of the things that I've thought a lot about is my own through line in all of this work, the prison work, working with survivors, working with students at CIIS. And I think what I found in any of those sites or situations, it's really about shedding a light, offering a little bit of light into a place that is probably the least visible. And it's not about speaking for anybody. It's not about speaking in anybody else's voice except to say that there are places in our world that are less visible to the rest of us. Sujatha often has said, or I've heard her say this once, and now I've kind of used it on my, you know, quite a bit, is that Gandhiji said that we should be making policy for the last girl in the last village. And when we're doing that, we're actually working towards equity and justice. And in, if we translate that into this country, that sometimes that last girl is a small child who is sexually abused sitting at home in her house. Sometimes that's a family who has just crossed the border into the U.S. from Mexico, and sometimes that person is sitting in a prison cell. And in the world of, in sort of this kind of prison criminal justice reform world, people who have committed sexual harm are pretty much at the bottom of the totem pole. They are the least visible, they are the most pathologized, and the most considered to be the most unhuman. And so the notion of, even in the, you know, in all of the work that's being done that's really progressive, when you start to talk about the fact that you're working with sexual offenses, people kind of look at you cross-eyed and like you're a little bit insane. And the vision that comes up is usually of some unknown, ominous, serial, you know, child abductor, which we know in the world and realm of sexual harm is not sort of what who usually commits sexual harm. It's usually somebody who is close to home. And so to just spend time really in places that are really kind of demystifying, you know, who different people are, and getting a sense of how we cross these lines so that we can actually see each other's shared humanity, because there is so much us and theming. There's so much woundedness and there's so much defensiveness. So for me, whether it's working in those areas, I also just in like 2 weeks from now, we're starting a project to work with 20 correctional officers in Massachusetts who are stepping off of the line, because to learn how to do peer support trauma and healing and resiliency groups for themselves and for each other. And this is, again, one of the most invisible places, right, to actually think about the humanity of a correctional officer, when usually we're even on the liberal progressive side saying, well, they do that and they do these things and they're terrible people. But a torturer, or so-called torturer, was not born a torturer, right? A person who has committed a very serious offense was not born to do that. So how do we actually sit there with our hearts and kind of create that humanity? So that is that's some of the work that I'm doing.
Thank you so much, Sonia. It's so beautiful. I love your description of the us and theming. And I think of you as someone who, from the beginning of knowing you, were always reticent to do that. You know, never us and theming. It's sort of not a line that you're willing to draw through your own heart. And so I just really appreciated that. And it sort of ties into my next question, which is a reprise of Preetha's question to me at the beginning of the call. I think of you, and it's not unrelated to your sort of, it seems like, inability to us and them. I think of you as beautifully gifted at getting people to explore and unveil sort of their deepest fears and behaviors that are often associated with shame for the things that they've done and the things they've experienced. So in your work, people tell you both the worst things that have happened to them and the worst things that they've done. And it's often a person telling you both of those things. Because as we've discussed many times, you know, we're rarely all just one, if ever. So in your experience, what are the things that you do? How do you draw on things to build trust that allows for people to get in touch with and break silence about these very painful things?
Yeah, thanks, Sujatha. And I would start out echoing a lot of what you said, which is showing up with your heart and, you know, coming with vulnerability and really building relationships, right? So I would say there's like five or six things that are really important. One of the most critical is being committed to the building of those relationships. And relationships take time. So any kind of deep processing work or deep work with each other where people feel comfortable saying the worst thing that ever happened, worst thing that they've ever done, sometimes it happens right away, but it also does take time. The second thing is, for me, is really coming with a sort of what we would call like a power with approach, right? Not a power over or power under approach. So the sense is that I don't walk into a room and assume that I know more than anybody else in that room. I also have to be utterly conscious and aware that I actually have more power over everybody else by the nature of the fact that I'm an outsider walking in, by I'm a free person, by I'm the teacher, I'm the facilitator. And it would take one thing, right, for me to abuse my power and to make someone feel small, to get them in trouble. And so this sense of being utterly conscious and aware and actually naming that right away to demonstrate to a group of people that that this is a place that you can actually even question me and question all of us who are coming in and kind of just holding the space. The third thing, which related to my question that I put up on the Awaken call, is this sense of being grounded in love and compassion and non-judgment and non-shaming, right? So a person has to believe you, that you're willing to hear the craziest, the worst, the most insane thing that they think, right, that they've ever done. And so it reminds me of this one man that I met years ago inside San Quentin who, and by the way, as I'm telling these stories, I have permission to tell them, so there's no breaking of confidentiality. So when he first came, he used to, and this group lasted 80 weeks. We met once a week for 2 hours. And when he first came, he used to say, I am an evil person. I am just straight up evil. I'm the worst person you've ever met. Now, this guy had done some pretty serious stuff, right? He had a history of pretty severe gang violence, and he was a really well-known pimp. And so on the one hand, while he would say, I'm evil and I'm a terrible person, on the other hand, in his disposition, he was like the most gentle creature I'd ever met. And, you know, on the third hand, he would say things all the time that were like, you know, sometimes you got to just kidnap a woman, tape her up and throw her in your trunk. So, you know, in those moments, if I were to wave my big fat feminist finger at him and be like, how dare you say that? And don't you know, that kind of anger would produce in him, like, I'm just going to shut up now, right? I'm not going to say anything. This is not safe for me. This is too scary. I'm too ashamed. And maybe I'm actually that evil person. So there's a way of just showing up with a genuine sense of love for even that sort of that quote-unquote worst thing, right? So weeks and weeks went by, and there's this narrative that keeps unraveling itself in many different ways. And around the 40th week, he was starting to kind of break more open into his life and different things that had happened. And it turns out that his mother was a call girl, and his mother he grew up with just his mother. And when he was 5 years old, his father tried to kill him. His mother took the bullet for him. And he had this incredible sense of protection that he was supposed to have for his mother his entire childhood into adulthood. And I remember asking him this question on that 40th week, which was, do you remember a time in your life that you didn't think you were evil? And he told the story about being 7 years old and sitting on the couch with his mother in the rain, eating grilled cheese sandwiches, watching television, and it was the time that he thought he was not a bad person. And he told this story about how he made a very conscious decision a moment after to never have anybody hurt him or his mother or anybody in his family, and he was going to be the baddest motherfucker you ever met. And that's what he became, right? And it was in that moment that he was really able to pull apart the difference between who he actually was, his true nature, and the actions that he started to commit, the sort of the actions that were harmful. And so I think that's a really good highlight of this whole process. And it's not just me, but a group of people sitting together and really holding the space for someone like this man to be able to come to the place where he realized these things about himself. So a couple things that happen when people are able to say the worst thing that they ever did or experience that breaking of the silence. I was in a prison 2 months ago where a man who was a sexual abuse survivor, had never told anybody in his life that he was a survivor of child sexual abuse. This was the second day of a two-day workshop. He told 24 people and myself that he was a survivor. He'd never even told his best friends. When I asked him how he felt afterwards, he said he felt elated. He felt joy. He felt relieved. And that's a common experience, right? So everything that I'm saying are just patterns that other people have said. So the sense of really dealing with the silence and the shame and the stigma that produces a kind of healing, or it's the beginning of producing a kind of healing, that can relate to self-forgiveness, that can relate to forgiveness of others, and often relates also to then being able to be accountable. Because once you feel that sense of healing oneself and a sense of self, it's much easier to step into the role of saying, okay, now I did that to you. And again, it's going back to separating that person, that self, from the action, right? The other thing that I think would probably be really interesting to this community would be that something that's very common that I've heard many, many people talk about is the healing that produces a kind of selflessness, right? So as folks are going through different experiences and really coming into themselves and going like, wow, you know, I feel better, I'm addressing the shame, these things are happening, there's this sense of not wanting to be greedy about it, you know, wanting to be like, well, if I'm experiencing this, damn, then I really want other people to experience this too, and I want to be a part of that. And there's a lot of the rhetoric that's used inside is, I want to give back, I want to give back, I want to give back, and translated into this community is a selfless action, right? So that's another thing. And then I think the other two things is just this sense of being witnessed, being heard. There are many, many times I've been sitting in groups where people have said, I wasn't going to share anything about myself. I didn't trust any of you. But since this sister next to me just shared, or this brother next to me just shared, I feel like I owe it to the group. It is my respect of this group that I have to share something that's really important. So what does it do when your Sangha, when your community is actually propping you up and building you up so that you feel enough sort of self-confidence to share something? I think also this whole piece, when we're doing this work together and we're sitting in a circle and we're listening to each other and we're all just talking to each other, it rebuilds a radical sense of trust and the belief in humanity that can be restored in a lot of relationships that are broken, right? So there's this subset of things that happen in group experiences, which is really about the circle kind of being a microcosm of all of the things that happen in our lives, right? So in a circle of 80 weeks, I'm going to sit there, and in the group, people are going to love you, they're going to hate you, you're the good sister, you're the bad mother, you were the really good girlfriend, it's all happening, right? And there's this really wonderful unconscious process that seems to be going on where when we're consistent and caring and compassionate with each other, we have this opportunity to sort of rebuild relationships that weren't working. So those are some of the really important things. The one other thing that I want to mention too, which I think is at the root of all of this, is understanding the nature of harm, right? So there is no one way that harm or violence occurs, right? There's a multitude of reasons that are grounded in interpersonal reasons, structural reasons, historical reasons, economic reasons, reasons for oppression, of childhood trauma, that are in a complicated way interrelating in somebody's life to produce and create the conditions where somebody chooses going down a path that is harmful. And this whole process is really about unwinding into where did things go haywire? You know, what is the cause of the cause of the cause of the cause of why I committed a crime? And in our little world, we have these cute little sayings, but they're helpful. One of them is this notion that hurt people hurt people. So that because I've experienced hurt in my life, because I've experienced quote-unquote trauma, suffering, that I probably didn't have as a young person the opportunity to explore, to process. It might not have been safe. Maybe there weren't caregivers in my life. There's a lot of structural inequity around me that can produce hurt of other people. And so There is this, I mean, and this is in our world, in the whole theory of, you know, trauma and violence, this is like a well-established relationship. So you can think about a really simple example in lay terms, right? So say, for example, for me, I'm in a relationship at work with somebody who reminds me of my brother. My brother who, you know, this isn't true, actually, my brother was wonderful, but my brother who maybe I felt like I always couldn't speak to, I felt invisible around, I felt like he was dominating, and this person at work reminds me of my brother, and because I've never addressed the issues with my brother, I'm like, you know, this person at work is like nagging me and kind of, you know, acting certain ways around me, and I can't seem to tell them that it's not okay, right? So it's like a pressure cooker. I'm like a pressure cooker. It starts to build up and build up and build up until one day I explode. But I probably don't explode onto my boss or the person at work. I probably explode onto Sujata because she's my friend and I can, or I explode onto somebody I don't know. So it's that same sense of how when we don't deal with kind of what's going on with us, what are old patterns and old relationships that we're holding on to that can produce some kind of violent peace. And then the last thing I want to say, which I think I'm just becoming more interested in as time moves on and kind of more grounding spiritual framework is, I've been really interested in thinking about, like, what is the role of all this stuff around trauma? Because right now we're talking about it in this kind of lens of, like, sociology and psychology, right? And, like, restorative justice and stuff like that. But where is the place and what is the role of trauma in sort of the karma-dharma cycle, right? And in relationship to one's own spiritual path, and how does it relate to spiritual foundation? And for me, that's a very personal inquiry. It's definitely coming from a very, very personal place of trying to understand that within myself. And I wrote this on, I think I wrote this on the piece of the call that, you know, that I've known men who've spent 20 years in solitary, who've suffered great abuses, whose lights are so bright that it's impossible not to see them. And then I know men who, and women who have everything that shrink into depression and suicidal thoughts. And I really wonder what causes one to choose you know, the light or come into the light and another not to. And I don't think I can answer that question, right? I don't think that there's like one reason for anything, but I came across this passage, it's a Pema Chodron quote, that I really loved, which she said, when even a momentary flash of bodhicitta is born, in that instant we become a child of the Buddhas and worthy of universal respect. Bodhicitta is not some elite theory for sophisticated or well-educated people. It's for everyone. So hearts awaken in solitary confinement, and hearts close on Wall Street, and hearts close in solitary confinement, and hearts awaken on Wall Street, right? And I really wonder about, in terms of all this community stuff, what is it about the community and the Sangha that actually can support the sustaining and the awakening of the heart in the same way that these awakened calls do, or an awakened circle does. That was a long answer.
That's fine. There's so much. And I, you know, and there's just so many amazing experiences that you have. I think a few of the things that I pull from what you said, some of the words that jumped out at me were, so this idea of a contagion of vulnerability, in a sense. I mean, contagion in the best sense. And this feeling that of generosity amongst incarcerated prisoners who are sharing, you know, incarcerated people sharing about the sexual harm that they've caused or experienced, and that there's almost a sense of generosity of saying, oh, actually, I should share my story now, too. And we know, you know, in prison, folks don't tend to talk about what they did. You know, it's kind of the number one thing that volunteers are told, don't ask people what they did. And so it's an amazing thing, this sort of contagion of vulnerability that you're fostering amongst people. And I think really one of the other themes that I pulled from what you just said that was so so deep was the notion of the cause of the cause of the cause of the cause of the why, and the time it takes to get there. You know, you said, and on the 40th week he was able to say, you know, and that's something that we don't, you know, we usually go for our 1 week therapeutic healing and our, you know, 5 day, this and that and the other, and that these really are longer journeys, right, to unpeel the onion. And the amount of time that you invest
in folks is, I think, really evident from what you're sharing. I wanted to ask a little bit more about sort of you and what it is really that brings you to want to be in a prison for some 40 weeks plus. What is it that brings you to want to be at CIS at any part of this that it is that you do? A little bit about what draws you to the work that you do.
Yeah, thanks. I would, you know, just before that question, Sujatha, I would add that, I mean, because you and I do this work, right? And that sometimes it is the 40th week, and sometimes it's on the first day, and sometimes it's on the second day. And I think there's like a desperation that people have to heal, to talk. And so when there's even an inkling and a glimmer of safety and compassion and sort of an open heart and open space, people will share. Sujatha and I were in a conference where there were a number of survivors, and it was like a bombshell. It was one after the other after the other. And this was a conference. This was a 90-minute session. Almost that it was like, wow, you know, how are we here that people are saying kind of these things that they haven't really said out loud. So what? Why? You know, why? This is a question. It's like going to be the lifelong question, right? And so I think that I can probably just poke at the truth for myself, and maybe in this round of the questions, just kind of answer it from more of like a life experience place. But, and I wrote this on the page, but I grew up my parents are immigrants. I grew up in New York. They were the only people in our family to leave India, and you know, didn't have a lot of savviness necessarily to like very like hardcore Manhattan culture, and so it was a really hard transition, I think, for my family to move and be really isolated, even though the city is a great place to live. When I was young, I had experience of child sexual abuse, and it was one of my first memories, actually, was being quite terrified. And terrified so much so that I describe it as sort of this experience of my first 18 years was kind of like this locking myself in the bathroom because dealing with the world and being in the world was way too scary. And, you know, that was a combination of a product of an early sexual abuse experience with parents that were beautiful and wonderful but did not know how to navigate the environment around them, and we're, you know, struggling to also navigate themselves. And so I think, you know, when I was, I kind of had an inkling that when I would leave home, I would probably be able to start figuring out who I was, and that was pretty much true. So when I left to go to college, I started, you know, at 18, my kind of own self-exploration, and that journey kind of began. And I feel like I have a lot of experience sitting in the darkness in my bathroom. Literally, I used to lock myself in the bathroom of our two-bedroom apartment because it was the only place I felt like I could be that was safe. And since I feel like I've had those experiences, it feels like it gives me some capacity to sit in some spaces that are pretty dark. And also I just think I have a more of an inclination to wonder why we're all not shedding the light on folks that have less light on them. And so why are we, the other day, for example, I was at a faculty meeting at my school, and there's a proposal on the table to give some release time for assistant and associate professors and not full professors, right, because they really need it. And in this faculty meeting, you know, the full professors are getting up and saying, but I really need it too, and I'm in the height of my creativity. And I was sitting there thinking, wow, you know, the ones who really need it are actually the adjunct professors and the assistant professors, right? The folks that are juggling five jobs and really have no time to write. And so I, you know, raised my little hand and I stood up and I said, I think I'd like to make a proposal in the opposite direction, which is that we forgo any kind of leave, you know, three credit for the adjuncts and assistant professors. And I just really taking ownership that it's not about, can we all just be called to really think about who needs it the most And I want to hold myself to that, and I'm hoping that we can become a culture in this school where we hold each other to it. So how to even do these things in a way with each other that aren't like blaming and shaming, but just saying like, can we in this whole model of scarcity, can we hold to our best selves, right? Can we become our best selves? And then I just think I have lots of questions about humanity and human nature, about our capacity to heal and be full, about how harm happens, about justice and injustice. I think those are the things that call me to or brought me to do this work.
So in this, you know, that takes courage to be at your meeting and raise your hand and push back. You know, it's even when it's against your own self-interest, right? And when it's because you would have benefited from the policy that people were suggesting in the opposite direction. And, you know, and regardless of whether or not it's speaking up for oneself or speaking up for others, that pushback takes courage. And I'm, you know, you've always struck me as someone with a very strong moral compass. And it's, you know, taken different permutations over your lifetime. What I know is that you've had really a long-standing yoga practice. And a couple of years ago, I know because I was with you, you went to Ladakh, you know, and spent a large part of your summer there receiving teachings from His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, the Kala Chakra teachings there. And there's so many other ways in which you engage spirit and spirituality. I'd love to know a little bit about sort of what it is that you characterize as your relationship of spirit and spirituality to your work and vice versa. So, or vice versa, whichever way you want to address it. Just thinking about sort of what it is on the spirit and spirituality side that grounds you to be able to do the really hard things, you know. It's not at all an exaggeration to think of some of the prisons that you go into and some of the meetings with high-level officials that you go into as what we'd maybe call the hell realms in Buddhism. And so, you know, you clearly draw on some very deep things in order to do that, and I'd love to know a little bit about that piece.
Yeah, I really appreciate, yes, the high-level meetings are definitely one of those realms for sure, just to say that out loud. And, you know, this is probably the question that I'm the most excited about and also the one that I'll probably fumble through because it's the newest for me, which is maybe the most exciting in some ways. So I think to answer this question, I feel like I have to fast forward and then rewind a little bit. And it has a little service space story in it as well. So I'm fast forwarding to July, just this July, about a month and a half ago, where by some serendipitous chance, I end up at this 90th birthday celebration for a beautiful brother, David, invited to be there by Nipun. And, you know, I was sitting there at this really gorgeous celebration, which was like 7 or 8 hours long, and I was really, really struggling and asking myself this question about, you know, the relationship of trauma in this whole cycle of in the Dharma and also in my own karma, right? And I'm very, very clear that in my own karma, I have to work through the trauma. I have to get over my fears and my terror and all that stuff. It's kind of flip, but it's not flip at all. And so we're standing online to get a hug with Guri and Nipun with Brother David, which we never got to the end of the line. But so Nipun asked me this question, you know, how did you know that you have, you know, come on this path? And I think I gave him some half-assed answer that I was actually really unhappy with. And I spent a lot of time, like, thinking about that answer, you know, sort of fumbling through it. Well, maybe it was here and maybe it was there. And, you know, I was pretty uncertain. And afterwards, I thought a lot about it. And I've thought about a lot about it since, about the sense that I feel like I've always been on a spiritual path or I've always been a seeker, but it was very, very difficult for me from due to my own early childhood experiences to differentiate sort of my true nature, my true calling from how I operated out of the deep terror of childhood trauma in those early years. And sitting with that, basically that kind of moment and starting to realize that there was actually pulling apart, it was like I found the coat hanger, like two coat hangers, where then I could start separating my many different experiences in my last 43 years and put them on different racks And in a way, I was doing what a lot of the men inside and the women inside do, which is separating myself from the actions that I had committed or created or done. Some of those really positive and some not so great. And so while my first memory in preschool, one of them was around, you know, being really afraid around child sexual abuse and the terror that it produced, the other memory was standing in a line at preschool, looking out into the world and wondering why everybody looked so lonely, why there was so much greed, and why the world was oriented in the way with such a fast-paced sort of sense about it. And so I have started to look through my life and kind of, you know, separate onto these coat racks the difference between these moments where I was really, I think, in an expression of justice, which I think justice is an expression of spirituality for me. It was at an early age. It still is. And when I say justice, I think also that translation into this world is really about selfless action, right? So, or selfless service. So, you know, when I was in high school, I started a young socialist club. I don't think you even know this, Sujatha. I used to sneak out to meetings to go to the City University of New York. I snuck out to D.C. to go on protests. And that was sort of my little expression of, you know, that this things aren't right. And, I mean, I could go on and on, right? But those are some examples. And at the same time that that was happening, I was hiding from the world. I was abusing my body. I was drinking. I was doing drugs. And I was shoplifting. So let me take both of those experiences, right, and say, okay, which one was really like, you know, the truth of my awakened self, and which one was the one that kind of fell asleep and that was harming myself and starting to harm others. And so, you know, as my life progressed, I had interesting experiences in college and in graduate school that sort of shoved anything spiritual under the rug. I went to college. I went to Brown at the height of modernity, of postmodernism. So anything spiritual was anti-intellectual. Every word, thought, action was make-believe, and it was all deconstructible, right? The world was empty and nihilistic. And I kind of bought into it because it was a framework that was all around me. And when I went to an art school, it was more of the same, where aesthetics was naive, beauty was anti-intellectual, and this whole notion of conceptual art followed this sense of postmodernism, which only high art making was acceptable, and spirituality was definitely a bad word. At the same time, I buy into this. I believe it. I'm working. I'm in education. I'm actually working with women in prison. I was doing a lot of work in community. So it was a really confusing lifestyle to have both. In my 20s, I had some experiences that were, you know, more harmful, unfortunately, that led me kind of to go into the fall asleep place a little bit more hardcore. And I kind of like shut down the other parts of myself for a while. I decided I'm going to try to live a normative life. I'm going to like get married and have kids and try to do that thing that people do. And I did it for a while. And to be honest, you know, I think what happens is we can't really hide who we really are, right? So as much as I wanted to stay asleep, it was kind of killing me from the inside. And I was having, you know, I was still doing all this education work and justice work, and it got to the point where I just couldn't, like, hide any longer. I couldn't hide under the covers. I couldn't stay there. And all of this work has, you know, if anything, it's not really about me giving anything to anybody. What it's given to me is it's held a big, fat mirror up to my face and has said, it's time for you to, like, really, really wake up. And so I'm happy to report that, like, I'm much more awake, like being awake has won over being asleep, or at least until now. So fast forward to the Kala Chakra moment with you, Sujatha, that, you know, is even in that moment a few years ago, I knew that I had more of an inclination towards like a Buddhist path, even though I would describe myself as being like very interfaith in terms of like in terms of the way I look at the world. I found that just personally in this lifetime, that particular set of ideas and thinking is definitely resonates with me quite a bit. And I remember sitting there, like, being really confused about whether I would take refuge or not, and just, like, trying to read as much as possible, listening to all of you guys talk and kind of scratching my head. I actually remember you saying something to me, Sujatha, where you said, it's not like you have to know all the answers right now. You're just choosing a path. And I was like, oh, right. So I did. So, you know, on one, got down on one knee with, you know, 10,000 people in Ladakh in the heat, and took refuge. And I remember you actually turned to me and laughed and said, do you feel any different now? And I laughed back and I said, yeah, no. And so I knew that that was right. And what has happened more and more as things kind of become more alive for me is that, like, recently I've been rereading some books and some Buddhist texts that I tried to read like 2 or 3 years ago, and they're kind of coming alive for me in a way that they never have before. And so my experience of them is much more deep, and it's experiential, and I feel like I'm weeping now when I read a passage because I feel like I get it for the first time. And so I think where I am right now is like in this very beautiful, deep, composting, alive period where what I would love to do if I had my way is to spend, you know, like 2 years just being a student and learning and being really quiet and, you know, just sort of cracking open, I think, these new frameworks for myself, because I think they're the deeper frameworks that I've been longing to really hold and sustain me and hold and sustain this work and actually to perpetuate in a much greater way. The last thing I'll say about this is, you know, I had a really interesting experience understanding my relationship to meditation recently, which was that I never felt that meditation was accessible to me. I laughed, and I used to laugh out loud, like, yeah, right, like, I'm going to meditate. And my aversion to meditation was that my reaction to child sexual abuse has been extreme disassociation, right? And by disassociating, I mean like leaving my body, living in fantasy world, you know, just living in just somewhere else, you know, a lot of my time where it looks like I'm present. And meditation has, you know, calls us to the present moment, right? The moment that my keys are hitting the finger, my fingers are hitting the keyboard, the presence to my feet and my sandals, the presence to the sounds passing, the presence to my breath, all of it. And that basically, the idea of that, you know, really evoked, it just sort of reminded me of the extreme terror that I felt, right? The discomfort that I felt for 20 years in my own body and with people and everything. And so it's only been, you know, I mean, the reason I knew I could never have a desk job was because I would be getting up every 10 minutes and walking around because I needed to, right? It was very hard for me to concentrate. But I notice now, you know, that there's a really beautiful, tender piece that's happening where I will be present for 10, 20 minutes with my kids or doing something, and I don't even notice that I haven't been disassociating, which is a really wonderful experience. And I'm being cheeky and sort of funny about it because it's actually a lot more than 20 minutes these days. You know, it's a lot longer periods of time. And you know, I feel like this is where I'm at with the accumulation of like the work that I've done on myself.
That's great. This is Rita. I think we're reaching the top of the hour. Sonia, this is so amazing. Thank you for your wisdom, your sharing of your personal story, the amazing experiences you've had. I'm just so rich. Before, I'll let Sujatha ask one additional question now, but I wanted to open up the queue for our callers to ask questions of our amazing speaker, Sonia.
So, Sonia, I just want to really, really thank you for your transparency. You know, you are one of the rare people on the planet that I know who is willing to not have to be seen as a good Indian girl. And so the things you shared
that
today,
I definitely
really...
am not, yes.
Oh, but you are, you know, and this is the thing. It's time to really redefine what it means to be a good Indian girl.
this literally brings tears to my eyes, that people who are willing to go to India and to engage in service there for years, for people who are willing to go into prisons and sit with people who have done sexual harm, there couldn't be something that I can think of as more definitionally good than that. And I don't mean good in some sort of simple way, right? Deeply, deeply good. And so, something that came from the last thing you said was about being asleep to ourselves and sort of the harmful things that we do to ourselves and others. Really, it's just beautiful to see in your own life how clear that is, that that's a path born of trauma, and that your personal transparency in coming out of that and being unafraid to share your journey so that those of us who walk with shame about the things that we have experienced and done can feel also a little safer. So you walk what I said in the beginning of this call about the capacity for people to share because we ourselves are willing to say, hey, this happened to me, or I did this, or these are some ways in which I've been asleep and I want to wake up. So I just wanted to really thank you for that. And love that you're saying you can't hide who you really are anymore. I mean, it's always snuck out sideways who you really are, and it's beautiful to see it in its full manifestation now. And I think maybe in closing, I'd want to ask you sort of about maybe one thing that keeps you up at night and sort of what gives you hope about it today. So what's something that's on your mind and what keeps you and what keeps you hopeful in light of that?
Thank you. And I'll be quick because I know we want to get to questions. And I think what keeps me up is just how we are so deeply disconnected in a culture of individualism and capitalism and all of that stuff. And I don't really think it's who we are, what we were born to be. And so I think that's what keeps me up. And what gives me hope are things like this. Awaken circles give me hope. You know, it's another way everything that I'm saying, going to an awaken circle is a bunch of people sitting around together, loving each other non-judgmentally, right? And small acts of change that interrupt and break the individualism, the isolation, and modernity give me hope. Small gardens give me hope. Restorative justice practices give me hope. Berkeley Community Acupuncture gives me hope, right? These things, small things that people do to keep us in connection and to ground it in love.
Thank you, Sonia.
That's beautiful. Thank you, Sonia. I just want to remind our callers again, you can dial *6 to get in the question queue, and also via the web, you can ask a question at ask@servicespace.org, and also via live stream, there's a prompt for that. So I wanted to take the host prerogative, Sonia, if I could, and ask you a question myself. You talked beautifully about your own personal journey and kind of what drew you to the work and, you know, the spirals that you faced as a child and some level, I think you described as locking yourself in the bathroom. I'm wondering, can you describe a little bit your healing journey? Like, how did you come out of that period of the downward spiral? Were there moments where, what were the kind of small steps or the big aha moments that might have helped you kind of come out of that?
Oh, thanks, Preeta. There was a pretty significant moment just leaving New York, being 18, going to college. And, you know, I went to a college that was extremely nurturing, and I was around people who were very nurturing and that were curious about the world and engaged and big fat nerds like me. And I think there was something about, you know, being out of my environment and just feeling really safe and just really held, and where I was able to, you know, for the first time, I didn't actually know any of this until I was 18. I didn't remember anything. And it was actually it was like my third day at Brown that I started to have sort of those flash memories. And it wasn't surprising, right? I was away from the environment. I felt safe. I'm like all those folks that are on the 40th week, right, where I'm like, oh. And I think it was that really was those conditions that produced the ability for me to start the journey to go into sort of some of the harder things.
That's great. Awesome. So we have a question that came in from the live stream, who's in Pomona, California. He says, Sonia, thank you for your wisdom. I have learned so much from you. So much of this resonates so deeply. Can you share a bit about how you personally deal with secondary trauma or compassion fatigue? What does a facilitator do with the trauma they sit and listen to on a regular basis?
Oh, it's such a great question. You know, and the reality is that, you know, for me, I would say over the last 8 years, particularly around the work in prison, I had two really huge moments where I experienced that compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma, so much so that I ended up taking like 3 months of a break from doing a lot of the work. And what I noticed about it was that I was getting to the point where I was so deeply, deeply invested that I was losing myself, that I was unable to think about anything else but, you know, the work that I was doing. And I felt like I was kind of like living inside. And at some point, you know, I recognized it and I knew that I needed to take a break. And then I think, you know, it's been, you know, I've had this conversation with friends many times about there's like this rhetoric of self-care that it's important, like the general things, but I feel like sometimes with the extreme work, it's like beyond self-care. Like, what do I need that is beyond the daily self-care? And I don't mean rhetoric in a bad way. I mean that just like I can do these daily practices, and I do very often, that sustain me. And at the same time, I know that there's a bigger sustaining. And I think that's where I got to this summer, which I took a big break this summer and like really realized that the bigger, the more grounding framework that's going to sustain me is a deeply spiritual framework. And that is going to take a little time to cultivate. And as I rush back into the world, and September for me is a month of doing, you know, being inside a prison or inside a school or inside something for 10 full days out of 30, which is a lot for a teacher. As I rush back into it, I'm kind of like, oh my God, you know, how do I make sure that at the same time that I'm doing this now in the output mode, really cultivating those internal and much deeper frameworks. And I'm hoping that eventually I'm putting out into the universe, I'm pretty full this whole year, but that next year I start to create a lot more spaciousness to be able to do that. And so I think to this caller's question, you know, it's like sometimes, you know, it feels like we just have to crack into the outside of the daily practices, those really, really deeper spaces that we're going to need in our lives to hold us together and to sustain us.
I'm curious, just following up on that, when you talk about your daily practices, and I know that I'm sure they shift over time, but can you kind of describe roughly now what your daily practices are?
And, absolutely.
Do you have circles and people you participate with that also help you?
Yeah, no, so many things. So, you know, I do a little bit of meditation every day. I used to be really, really, I have a lot of people that are in my life that I can call when something happens. I reach out to them much more than I ever did before. But I think the most significant and probably different thing is I used to struggle a lot with transitions. So I'd be like, go, 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 yeah, like, right, 3 days on, you know, I don't need to drink water or eat anything, you know, and I'm good. And then I'll get on a plane and move right into the next thing, right? And like, and that was my mode, right? It was just working in intensity mode. And then my body, like, 5 days, 7 days later falls apart, right? And I'm like, oh my God, I'm sick. And I know why, but that's okay. This is just the cycle of what happens, you know, and kind of even like justifying that. And so now I'm forcing myself to build in transition time. I'm forcing myself to come back on a plane a day early. I'm forcing myself to eat. the person I co-facilitate with at this one prison, you know, I really rely on her. She actually brings lunch for us, and she brings food, and she brings water. And she knows, and she said, well, one of my jobs is to remind you to drink water and to eat. because the first day we went in, I didn't do either. And so so I think, like, you know, there's a combination of just, like, of relying on others and then really, really having, you know, I think one of the big things in all of this work and is this sense of this critical self-insight, self-reflection of just constantly asking myself, like, what do I need to be doing differently? What should I be doing better, both in the work and also for myself? And then how do I start to actually implement those things?
Thank you. Okay, now we're going to go to our next questioner.
Hello. My name is Alisa, and I'm in Seattle, and I just want to thank you so much for being so open and sharing. And something you just said just made me think, oh, my gosh, one of my beacons that I've had this year is nourishment. And when I think of what you just said as far as giving yourself time and space, I thought the work you do is nourishing this openness and this light, but there's all sorts of ways of nourishing ourselves and drinking and nourishing our body and nourishing our spirit and giving ourselves space. And when we're in an intensive moment, then standing back and getting perspective, because that's part of the balance. And it's just something that just popped into my head when you said that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Did you, thank you for your thoughts, and thank you for your, thank you for your reflection.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.